I am sitting in lovely Siesta Key, Florida.
I'm coming from Bangkok in Thailand.
Prague in the Czech Republic.
Cairo in Egypt.
Auckland, New Zealand.
London, England.
Welcome to Career View Mirror, the automotive podcast that goes behind the scenes with key players in the industry, looking back over their careers so far, sharing insights to help you with your own journey. I'm your host, Andy Follows. Hello, and if you're a regular listener, thank you and welcome back. In these Side Mirror episodes, I introduce concepts, tools and experts that help you enable fulfilling performance for yourself and the people you lead and care about. If you're listening for the first time, hello, I'm Andy Follows. I help business owners and executives to enable fulfilling performance for themselves and those they lead and care about. If you'd like to explore this further, sign up for our weekly newsletter, Release the Handbrake. It's packed with simple, actionable ideas to help you and your team increase performance and fulfillment. Just head to andyfollows.substack.com or check the show notes for this episode. Bob Bradley has held general manager, managing director and CEO roles in six different organisations. He's also guided corporate transformation projects and led hypergrowth division for a top consultancy. He's revitalised slowing revenues in mid-sized companies, led AIM listed and family-owned businesses and navigated post-merger integrations. His experience extends beyond operations. He served on 21 boards, commercial and not-for-profit, and even created and chaired trusts, including an employee ownership structure. But perhaps what he values most is the time spent engaging with fellow leaders. He's facilitated over 800 meetings and had confidential discussions with over 300 business leaders, and even arranged over 500 workshops with over 200 different speakers. These conversations, these shared experiences, have provided invaluable insights into the real-world challenges leaders face. He's now semi-retired from operational leadership and is passionate about sharing these insights. I was delighted to have Bob join me recently to create this Side Mirror episode on sailing in stormy waters. Survive and thrive in a difficult economic environment. Hello, Bob, and welcome. Where are you coming to us from today?
I'm in the glorious Cotswolds in West Oxfordshire, and it's a lovely sunny day today as well. Spring is coming.
Thank you very much for joining me. We're going to have a discussion about sailing stormy waters, how to survive and thrive in a tough economy. I'm really looking forward to it. It would be really helpful if we could start by talking about what you've done, where your experience has come from, and how you have arrived at the nuggets that you're going to share with us and the experience you're going to share with us in the conversation.
Do I start at the beginning or do I start at the end? Let's start at the beginning because it's simpler to think chronologically, but it's the end that's most relevant. So first job, post-degree, classic blue-chip corporate career. Got bored with that very quickly, joined a tiny business, found that was a bit lacking headroom, so joined a big business again. So I flipped in and out of different IT businesses, different training businesses over the first bit of my career. That was fantastic because it gave me quite a broad experience. You know, one of the advantages of IT is you work in lots of different functions, lots of different sectors. So it gave me a great broad background. But I finally found what I wanted to do, which was run what you might call medium-sized businesses. So I'm talking about up to 500 people. That was a sort of, in commercial sense, the peak of my career. Did that for a while, ran three businesses, an AIM-listed company, a family business, and a corporate subsidiary. And then I got fed up with working for other people and started my own business in 2004.
Right. I'm just going to jump in there because it does sound like I was getting echoes of Goldilocks with you trying lots of different things and working out what you liked.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the middle. The middle one was the right one for me.
Okay. So corporate role, also smaller businesses and managing three smaller businesses. Would you say smaller ones or medium size?
Small to medium, all over 100. So 100 to 500 businesses.
And doing that and finding that's the sweet spot until it gets to the point where you'd rather do it yourself. So you really have covered quite a range of experience there. Yeah. That was 2004. So what did you do when you stepped out in 2004?
Yes, and what I did then is probably most relevant to this is I'd been a member of what's called a business leader peer group when I was running the businesses. And 2004, I decided I could do it myself. And so I started a business which was about running groups of business leaders, a membership organization, and giving them a chance to talk to each other peer to peer and give them a chance to see some brilliant speakers. Did that for 20 years until about 2 years ago. And I've counted up some numbers. So some numbers for you. During that period, we had over 300 different members who I got to know quite closely. So lots and lots of different businesses. Breadth is one of the key characteristics of me, if you like. Breadth and depth around leadership rather than depth around any specific business. I'm not manufacturing, I'm not distribution, I'm not services. I've dabbled in all of them. So yeah, 300 odd members, and I ran over 800 meetings for those members. Sounds like a lot, but actually over 20 years, it's not quite so many. It's not even one a day. But what that did was gave me a massively valuable or interesting insight into the way leaders of operational businesses think. Operational business is a term I tend to use, the sort of business I work for. So it's beyond startup, but it's not a corporate with corporate structures and things. It's somewhere in the middle. Operational business, I sometimes even call them adolescent businesses because they're going through the adolescence of business life and have all the same, actually have the same challenges as, you know, human adolescents do, because they sort of are no longer a child, but they have childlike tendencies and they're not yet an adult. And they're trying to be at times trying to be an adult and at times trying to be a child and can get very mixed up. So it's a really tough phase in the growth of a business, I think, that middle adolescent years. I guess I had the good fortune of sitting in all those meetings, hearing lots of business leaders talking about lots of business challenges, being part of those conversations, understanding how they think, understanding what works, what doesn't work. So when I came to retire a couple of years ago, I decided that I almost had a duty to share some of this stuff that was floating around my head. I was desperate to try and capture it. And so that's what I'm doing now, writing books about it and talking about it.
That sounds absolutely fabulous. I can imagine in each of those 800 meetings, you're getting exposed to whatever challenges those leaders that have come along are facing, them sharing them openly, because you've created that kind of environment where they feel safe to just talk about what's keeping them up at night. And you're on the receiving end with such breadth, as you say, and no doubt noticing trends and similarities across industries and businesses that you're then able to filter and distill into what we'll talk about in this conversation. I'm sure it's come from 20 years of listening and observing.
Yeah, absolutely.
300 different businesses at close proximity. So well positioned to have this conversation. Thank you very much for joining me, Bob. It's a topic also close to my heart, the peer mentoring, because we've been running peer mentoring groups for 4 years now. So and I've been grateful for the little bit of mentoring you've given me so far. So looking forward to continuing those conversations. But shall we get into the topic then of sailing stormy waters, how to survive and thrive in a tough economy? Would you say we're in a tough economy right now?
Yes, and I think it's going to get worse for a while before it gets better. This year is going to be a very tough year, I think. And I think the forecasters are probably underestimating how tough from the people I'm talking to.
So if you're mentoring businesses or working with them now, what are you telling them to help them understand where your thoughts are coming from and to share your sense of what's in store in the next 12 months?
It's interesting because some conflicts in what I'm about to say, in that I think we need to be aware of what's going on in the economy, because it does make a difference. It makes a difference to our suppliers, our employees, ourselves, our investment plans and everything else. But having understood that, you need to think about it as a context. We're on audio, so people can't see me. But if you can imagine something flying through the air and hitting you from the side of the head, you need to be able to duck when somebody's swinging their arm at you or whatever. So you need to be aware what's going on. But the worst thing you can do is focus on it. and look at it. Yeah, you need to be focused on your business, not on the economy. So that's the first point I'd make, is don't let all the media and people like me or anybody distract you from your business, because it's your business that matters. That's the first thing I would suggest. You know, you shouldn't panic, shouldn't get distracted. It's all about, you know, how well are you running your business? That's the number one.
And how do you decide then what you should be focusing on within your business?
So I would put a bit of context on the impact of an economy. I'm talking about sort of normal operational businesses, the mainstream of businesses, as I say, I focus on between 50 and 500 people, that sort of scale. I'm not talking about Shell here. I'm not talking about BP. I'm not talking about Unilever. So actually, the way you're being affected by the economy is the same as all your competitors are being affected by the economy. So the first thing I would say is, it's an opportunity as much as it's a problem, because if it's a tough world out there, your competitors will be finding it tough as well. And if you're smart and agile and adaptable, you can use the recession to your advantage. Use tough economy to your advantage. We talked about peer groups in the financial crash 2008 and in COVID. I had a number of members who initially were scared by what's going on and worried about what would happen to their economy. But when they put some brain power into it, identified opportunities being created by the tough economy, and were smart enough and agile enough to move and take advantage. Because a tough economy nearly always pulls out opportunities as well. I mean, the classic is to think about a funeral director. A funeral director doesn't lose business during a crisis. And in fact, unfortunately, in the COVID crisis, they probably had extra business. Although it was different dynamics, obviously. Another example, the classic thing an accountant does in a boom time, they have people working on corporate finance, on deals and acquisitions and mergers and that sort of thing. In a tough time, when people are not so keen to buy businesses and acquire businesses, they turn those same people into recovery specialists, restructuring businesses financially. So, you know, we need to look at our businesses and say, where is the opportunity in this crisis for us? How can we be different? Remembering that we, as a small to medium agile business, can probably outplay the corporates. The corporates have got a juggernaut. It's very difficult to respond quickly and respond accurately. So we have, you know, it does create opportunities for us.
Okay, that makes sense. So if we're talking about a tough economy, that is something that's going to affect everybody. It's not like having an isolated issue in our business that's challenging us. It's a level playing field in terms of everyone being affected. And great examples of how some organisations, they alter their focus in order to continue making the most of the tough period. What would you recommend a business does in order to identify how it should shift? So it recognises, okay, I'm not going to panic. I recognise that all my competitors are facing the same challenges. This sort of situation does throw up opportunities for businesses. So what would you recommend I do to identify, you know, what for my business would be the equivalent of the accountant switching from M&A to restructuring?
Okay, so there are quite a few different things that I would suggest you can do, but it starts with your customers. And actually, before I go into the opportunities, I would say the first thing you need to do is secure the base. Make sure that your existing customers are as solid as you can make them. Make sure you're serving them well, because it's always cheaper to retain a customer than to win a new customer. So the first thing you do is look at your existing customers. However, taking into account the tough economy, I would encourage people to talk to the customers and understand the challenges the customers are facing that you might be able to solve, and might be able to solve with great products and services that you could easily do. It's from your customers you have your best ideas. I had a member of my peer groups who was in the IT sector, and they said, the problem with our industry is most of them are driven by geeks who spend their time looking at the great new technology. We don't. I spend my time talking to customers about what the problems are, and then I try and find technology to fix it. So I would encourage that sort of mindset. If you take the peer groups example, my own business grew massively during COVID because, talking to customers, they were absolutely desperate to talk to somebody about what's going on. What the hell is furlough? What are we going to do? You know, how are we going to manage this? What's your bank talking about? And so actually demand for our services had gone up, even though apparently, and some of my competitors shut down because we were based on in-person meetings. And so I quickly realized that we had to go online because people had even more need than they'd had previously. So we moved to an online model and have never gone back. We still include online meetings, or the business that I handed over a couple of years ago still includes online meetings as well as in-person meetings. So, you know, it's about talking to customers. As I say, I realized they were desperate to talk to people, but what they weren't interested in COVID was speakers, because they don't want a speaker about great strategies. They want to know what they're going to do tomorrow about this crisis that they're facing.
And they'd rather speak to someone in their peer group who's just done the same thing last week.
Yeah,
than exactly.
So yeah. We re-engineered the model quite significantly, but based on listening to what customers were saying, which is, I need to talk to somebody, but I don't want to hear about strategies and long and, you know, visions for the future. I want to know about survival.
Yeah. So we've got focus on the customer. Make sure you secure your existing customer base and identify within your customer base which of those are thriving or are actually going to be thriving in this changed economy, and which are going to be struggling, and how can you help them?
Well, there's actually two bits. There's talking to your customers about what their needs are and understanding them better, but there's also working out something that you hinted at inadvertently, I think, is working out which customers are going to be the ones that are going to have more budget, more need. If you look back at COVID, COVID is a great example. If your customers are distribution companies, they were booming. Yeah, they had more money than they knew what to do with. So if you were selling IT systems to distribution companies, you'd have been doing well. If you were selling them to high street retailers, then you've got a problem. So you should be redeploying your IT systems people, IT developers, to develop systems for distributors, not for retail stores, if that makes sense. So I've said, you know, you've got to look at your own business and look at how you can do well by developing what you do differently. But also when you look at your customer set, some of your customers will be in a good place, some will be in a bad place. And obviously the ones to target for new business are the ones that are doing well.
How far ahead are you looking? Because you want to look after customers who, I'm imagining, in the long term, you think, oh, they're going to bounce back afterwards and I want to have done the right thing by them. So are you trying to factor that in as well when you're doing this review?
Yes, in the sense of saying, you know, secure your existing customer base. You've already done the hard work of getting them as a customer, and make sure you're going to keep them so that when you get to the end of the recession, that the ones that are booming are spending money with you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about people, Bob? Because often what happens, particularly in US, you know, they're very quick to let people go when times get tough. What are your thoughts on these SME organizations? They might have people who are really important to them. I'm sure they do. People who are very important to them, who they've nurtured over, you know, they've invested quite a lot in over the years. And do you have a particular strategy or approach for deciding what to do with people in these in these times?
You asked a difficult question. I mean, there is obviously no simple, easy answer. You know, it's naive to say, oh, you keep everybody, look after your staff. That might not be possible. On the other hand, that's got to be the first starting point. What's interesting, I think, is that I see it in sort of three levels. I mean, the first starting point is to invest in your best staff and make sure they're loyal, give them a reason to stay, give them the vision of the future of where you're trying to head to. I've always found tough times to be the times when you build teams, because people work together to get through this crisis. So that should be the sort of first objective. But I don't want to duck the difficult issue of, you may not have the money to keep everybody. So you may have to then look at restructuring redundancies, things like that. But I would firstly encourage people to consult with their staff as they're doing that. You'd be surprised how supportive people are of each other. And I've known organizations, and it's not happened for me, but I've known organizations where staff have agreed to all take a 10% pay cut rather than lose staff. Through consultation, you can pick things like that out.
I've heard that. Sorry to interrupt, but I've heard that. And that also it kind of boosted morale as well. Yeah. So people took a 10% pay cut to help each other out and walked in to work with a spring in their step for having done something so noble, I suppose.
And if the leader's doing it properly and leading from the front and, you know, doing that themselves as well, or even I've known leaders, many actually, despite what the media thinks, most SME business leaders are not there solely for the money. And I've known many business leaders go without money for a while because the business couldn't afford it and they wanted to keep their staff. But as I say, I don't want to duck the difficult issue of the potential for restructuring and redundancies and that sort of thing. I see that in two levels. The first level is, as I say, despite the media portraying business leaders as sort of money-grabbing, evil sort of people, that's very rarely the case. So I think the first level is when the business leader finally confronts something they've been avoiding. There are often in businesses people who are not performing. They're in the wrong job at the wrong time with the wrong skills, the wrong role. And so the first level is to make sure you've addressed the things you should have addressed prior to the tight times, but you could get away with not doing it, so you duck the difficult question, the difficult conversations. So I think that's the sort of first level. Then obviously you're left with the position of, can you survive now, or do you need to reduce costs even more? And then you're faced with a really tough choice of people you really, really don't want to let go of, but you can't afford them. And then's when you've got to make some very careful decisions. And I think those start, as I sort of alluded to earlier with the customer, is understanding what is it that customers really, really value. And one of the reasons why I think tough times can be really good for businesses is because, again, it forces us to confront things we might otherwise not notice or not deal with. So if I take a silly sort of example of this, we often incur costs doing things that customers don't value, which sounds like a stupid statement. Why would anybody do anything that the customers don't value? Well, let me illustrate it. I'm not sure how the age of your listeners. I'm certainly quite a bit older than you, but you're probably old enough to remember when TVs were delivered complete with the instruction manual. It was about an inch thick. I certainly can remember the early PCs where you got three or four manuals that were 2 inches thick on MS-DOS and the IBM PC manual and all this sort of stuff. Do you see those today? No. We have far, far more sophisticated devices now. You know, thinking about your mobile phone, you know, it's more advanced than mainframe computers were in the 1960s and 70s. But we don't have any manuals for them. And it's because, and if you've ever spoken to anybody in tech support, as most people have, the classic phrase in tech support is about their clients is RTFM, read the manual. You know, why doesn't the client RTFM? Well, the clients don't read manuals. And so during tough times, somewhere in the last 30, 40 years, smart manufacturers have worked out that they were spending an absolute fortune on technical authors, book layout people, manual layout people, printing, getting manuals printed, and then revised every time something changed. You know, they were producing these manuals, and then when they got to the customer didn't value them. So some bright spark somewhere along the line has said, why do we do that? Oh, we can save some money there, and the customers won't notice. Now, I use that example because, bring it back to today and your listeners, is where is the instruction manual in your business? What is it you do that customers don't value? And it goes back to what I said right at the beginning. The starting point is talk to your customers, meet your customers, understand what they value, what they don't value, really get under their skin in a positive way and understand them, because that's how you go back to the office and say, actually, why do we do that? Do we need to do that? Is there a better way of doing this?
Yeah, I'm smiling because just before we started recording, I was explaining that we'd recently stopped doing transcripts because Apple introduced an automatic transcript service for any podcast that you put out there. And so we've saved a few hours a week by not also doing our own transcript. And so far, none of our customers have come and said, where's the transcript gone?
Brilliant example. Brilliant example from today. And I think there are always those things. And sadly, whilst it does mean the technical author is the one being made redundant, you know, that is a way of saving costs. It doesn't damage the service to customers, doesn't damage the service to anybody. And hopefully the technical author can be redeployed into another role, some either within your business or into a different business.
I'm already starting to feel a slightly different relationship with this tough economy, Bob, a different perspective based on what you've shared so far, which is we can see it as an opportunity. We can see it as, I'm thinking of a critical friend. It's not a critical friend, but it's something that's happening in the environment that is going to force us to make some of the decisions that we haven't been forced to make up till now. And it could be about having those difficult conversations with people who we perhaps should have let go before it got to this situation. And they might have even been better off if we'd helped them into a situation where they would be able to experience more fulfillment and perform at a higher level than they are now. And it's also that forcing us to look at our business and cut out the things we might be doing that aren't necessary. Mm. One thought that came to mind when you were talking about, you know, the people and what happens is people have a different level of ability to deal with uncertainty. And it could be that you've got actually your top players who you really want to keep, but they are less good at dealing with uncertainty. And so they end up looking for another job, and they sense there's some concern, and they preempt anything unpleasant happening because they're risk averse by finding another job, and you risk losing somebody good. So how do you handle communication at a time like this? Communication with your people? You sort of briefly alluded to it, but there's possibly also a temptation to bury your head in the sand and hide and not want to leave your office because people are going to ask you lots of questions about, are we going to be all right and what's happening? So what would you say about that?
Yeah, and you know, I don't want to underplay this stuff because it's horrible stuff to have to deal with and it's really tough. But, you know, leaders are paid to lead. You know, that's what you have to do. I often end up saying to people facing difficult situations, what you have to do is what's right for the business, not what's necessarily right for you personally, which is the easy way out of avoiding it, and not necessarily what's right for every individual in the business. You're there to make sure the right things are done for the survival of the business and the survival of the majority of the people as far as you can. So there's a few things that you have to sort of get your head around, really. And sadly, I've had to twice lay off a third of the staff of the businesses I was running for reasons that were nothing to do with us, really, at the time, and nothing to do with those individuals. And firstly, look inside my head as to why am I doing it? Am I doing it because I want to, because I'm mean, I'm nasty? That certainly wasn't the case. I didn't want to do it. But I realized it was my job to do it, and I had to do it in order to protect the jobs of the people remaining. So I was laying off a third of the staff to protect the jobs of the other two thirds. If I didn't do my job, everybody was going to end up without a job as the business went bust. So you firstly have to get in your own head why you're doing it, which if you're a good leader is for the best interests of the majority of the people. You have to take tough decisions. Then when you're communicating it, I learned the hard way not to expect those on the receiving end of a difficult conversation to necessarily understand, because, you know, it's very difficult to understand that you're the person that's no longer wanted. So I learned to give up on expecting them to understand my perspective and the business's perspective. I hope it's the business's perspective, not just mine. I'd really, you know, run it past boards and things like this. However, what I did set out, I always saw as my goal, was that they would say, in a year or two's time, when things had calmed down and the emotions were less raw, they might look back and say, yeah, I still think Bob made the wrong decision, but at least he handled it professionally and treated me fairly through the process. So wrong decision, Bob. I'm assuming that that's what they're going to think always, but I want them to think that I've handled them professionally and properly. So it was always about treating them humanely, you know, doing what I can to support them. And you mentioned certainty just now. One of the tricks of the trade, if you like, that I learned was people do want certainty. Sometimes you are unable to give them the full certainty you'd like to. But in the absence of doing that, try and give them what certainty you can. So, for example, in a redundancy process, you know the law, the way redundancies have to work. You have to put the pool of people at risk of redundancy. So, you know, when you do that, you're put in a position of uncertainty, which is difficult, but you cannot avoid it. It's part of the process that legally you have to follow. But what you can do is say, we will have completed this process by the 31st of March. And so on the 31st of March, you'll know whether you're going to continue with the business or not. And what you're doing there is giving them a certainty around the date of 31st of March. Now, it's not as good as the certainty of having a job forever, I appreciate, but it is giving them something to hook onto. And you'll be amazed how important that is to people, to give them a framework, or how dangerous it is to just leave it wandering, leave them unsure. You know, I've heard people say, I don't know what's going on. I wish I knew what's going on. You know, I wish they'd tell me. This is me earlier in my career. I remember people ranting about, why don't the bosses tell us what's going on? We know something's going on. Why don't they tell us? So I think you have to create the certainty you can do wherever you can. And also, I would then say we focused there a lot on the person on the receiving end of redundancy. And that obviously is big in your mind when you're the leader making these difficult decisions. You think about those people a lot and you think about how you're handling them. But actually, again, going back to your job as a leader to do what's right for the business, don't forget the 2/3 of people that are staying. Don't forget the people that are still in the business. And you have, of course, to communicate with them. And that communication is even more important because they're the people that you need to see that you're handling the people that are leaving professionally and fairly. They're the people you need to be able to explain why you're doing it. You're not doing this because you want to be nasty, you want to lay people off. You're doing it because you're trying to create a better business in the future. You're doing it to protect their jobs. You're doing it because there's a great future ahead. So, you know, I think it's very easy to get wound up and engaged on the difficult side of the conversation because it's so stressful and so emotionally difficult. But actually, don't forget the people that are staying and make sure you're communicating with them very effectively, very clearly, and selling them a great vision of where we're going in the future, how this is an opportunity for us, how we're going to come out of this stronger, because that's what happens. I sometimes use the power of evolution. You know, evolution, you know, is why we humans exist. The step by step we've got there. But, you know, there have been many species disappear over the years. It's the nature of Darwin's theory, really.
I think, yeah, if we can set aside the very personal, very emotional, very, you know, can be traumatic impact of being made redundant and just look at this as an organism, if you like, looking at the company, there's an organism that's evolving, and we can see how times like this can be, you know, healthy and can cause a business to then enter another phase, go through a tough time, shed some, you know, a little bit like an animal shedding some molting or shedding some skin, and then off it goes into the next phase. You mentioned moving people around as well. I just want to touch on that because I think you would always not rush to making people redundant, because however well you communicate with the people who are left, they still now know this is an organization that does let people go sometimes. And if that's the first time it's happened, that can rock their world a little bit. So it's not something you would do unless you had to. Is there anything to add on moving people around into different roles? I mean, you gave the example of the accountants moving from M&A to restructuring. Is it worth saying a bit more on that?
The thing that strikes me when you were saying that, of course, is you and I have both made the mistake of referring to people being made redundant. Technically, that's not the case. We do not make people redundant. We make roles redundant. And yeah. I think that's quite an important bit. There are quite a few aspects of the labour laws I don't agree with, you know, like having to put a whole pool of people at risk when you don't need to. I think that's an unfortunate consequence of the labour laws. But one of the things I think is really good is that it's the role that's redundant, and you have an obligation then to look around for, can that person do a different role in the organisation? And if we look at the wider context, the last 20, 30, 40 years, there's been a shortage of good, capable people. And most of the time, most business leaders are desperately trying to find the good, capable people. And so it's quite possible you've got capable people that just happen to be in a role that the business no longer needs or isn't suitable for them. And so if you follow the redundancy process properly and genuinely and look for alternative roles, you often find that there are people are capable of turning their hand to something else. And indeed, I would say some of the best appointments I've made, not necessarily through the redundancy process, have been when we've redeployed somebody into a role that was completely odd at face value place to move them. But you discover that this is a sort of made up example, but it's based on things I have seen happen. And that is, some of the best salespeople are often engineers. You know, if you find the engineer that has the interpersonal skills to become a salesperson, then they often are far more effective than the mainstream person who's been in sales forever, because they can, if they need to, dive into the geeky technical stuff and have credibility with some of the technical buyers. You know, that's a classic case of, you know, if you've got to let go of some engineers, or in them redeployable as salespeople that you can't find enough good people for.
Yeah.
Some people have the aptitude that's never been realized. And your job as a leader is to spot that potential in somebody and to realize it.
I like that very much. And I can see how that would be very beneficial to the business to move people around like that. Let me take a moment to tell you about our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Ask Consulting, who are experts in executive search, resourcing solutions and talent management across all sectors of the automotive industry in the UK and Europe. I've known them for almost 20 years, and I can think of no more fitting sponsor for CareerView Mirror. They're the business we go to at Aquali when we're looking for talent for our clients and for projects that we're working on. Ask was founded by Andrew McMillan, whose own automotive career includes board-level positions with car brands and leasing companies. All Ask consultants have extensive client-side experience, which means they bring valuable insight and perspective for both their employer and candidate customers. My earliest experience of working with Andrew was back in 2004, when he helped me hire regional managers for my leasing sales team at Alphabet. More recently, when Aquali was helping a US client to establish a car subscription business, Ask Consulting was alongside us, helping us to develop our people strategy and to identify and bring on board suitable talent. Clients we've referred to Ask have had an equally positive experience. Andrew and the team at Ask are genuinely interested in the long-term outcomes for you and the people they place with you. They even offer the reassurance of a 2-year performance guarantee, which means they have skin in the game when working with you. If you're keen to secure the most talented and high potential people to accelerate your business and gain competitive advantage, do get in touch with them and let them know I sent you. You can email Andrew and the team at hello@askconsulting.co.uk or check out their website for more details and more client feedback at www.askconsulting.co.uk. Ask is spelt A-S-K-E. You'll find these contact details in the show notes for this episode. Okay, let's get back to our episode. What should we focus on, Bob, then? Because there are other things you would be doing, I'm sure. What would you most like to stress as being an important action to take?
So I think one positive one, and then one managing some more tricky stuff in different dimension. The positive one, I saw talking at the beginning about looking for opportunities. Look for opportunities created by the tough economy. Some of your competitors might be not doing it quite as smartly as you. Big companies have a tendency in a tough economy to say, okay, we want 10% cost cuts across the board, which is a stupid way of doing things because you cut the costs of serving your best customers. It's done in a blanket way, in a non-intelligent way. And so it might be that some of your competitors are doing things that actually play into your hands. You know, they've cut 10% from customer service, so their customers are not getting the service they demand. Massive opportunity for you to be there to pick up the pieces and to take the crumbs from their table, if you like, particularly if your competitors are a major corporate. Likewise, the other business that's your size maybe may be not as well led as your business. You might be a smarter leader than they are, and they might be in trouble. So it might be a chance to do an acquisition. I've got one particular member I can think of that I think did 2 or 3 acquisitions following the financial crash of competitors. One of them was a proper acquisition, but certainly one of the other ones, he deliberately, this is sort of mean but appropriate and nothing, you know, nasty personal about it. He put money aside saying, I think some of our competitors are going to go bust. I want to have money ready so that when I hear they've gone bust, I can speak to the administrator and buy their stock on the cheap, because the administrator would be trying to sell it off as a fire sale, which of course they do, and they did. So he bought, you know, stock very cheaply. Could see what was going on, could see what was happening. It's the same principle of looking for the opportunities, but now it's looking for the opportunities created by your competitors' mistakes, because under pressure, they might make mistakes. And of course, you're not going to, but they might. So that, you know, there's another positive opportunity there. Before I turn to the negative.
Yeah, I think that's fair. What happened there is a good example. It's very astute of him. But, and I also have experienced the 10% cuts all round, rather than, you know, looking a little bit more into detail and deciding where we should cut the cloth.
It's lazy leadership, lazy management, you know, to do it that way. You know, you need to use a brain. You need to be, you know, you're paid to think and be intelligent about your strategic business decisions. So, yeah, 10% across the board is not a good way of doing things.
No, let's see what else there is then.
Okay, so I was what I wanted to move on now to was a more difficult space of just recognizing some realities, which is, you know, if in a tough time, you may be finding cash is running out. You may be getting short of cash. So in that situation, there's a number of things you need to do. Firstly, the accounts will all tell you to make sure you've got tough credit control processes in place, that you're making sure you're not the one with a £100,000 bill invoice out to a customer that goes bust that you can't get back from the administrator. So make sure you know what you're doing in terms of sales. One of the comments somebody made to me years ago was selling something for £100 that never gets paid for is just £100 thrown away. So you don't need the bad debts in those circumstances. Better to walk away from that business if you're not going to get paid, sadly. Then looking at your own costs, you've got credit control in place. How are you going to save money? And I think there's a couple of levels there where you may have to make decisions that you don't want to make. And those decisions may relate to marketing, they may relate to products. So let me put it this way. There is no point in developing a new marketing strategy to generate leads in a year's time if your business no longer exists in a year's time. So you need to be very tightly focused in your marketing. If you're short of money, make sure that what you're spending money on has got a return on investment that's quick, that comes back. Obviously, in a normal times, you want to be investing in things for a year's time, 2 years time, 5 years time. You need to be investing in the future of your business. But you've got to recognize the reality. There's no point in doing that if your business is not going to be there as a consequence. It's a waste of money then. And so you need to be looking at when is the return on investment around marketing. And then the mirror image thing is exactly the same around product development, developing new services, new products. Yeah, we should all be doing it. And in normal times, we should all be doing that sort of stuff. But if you're in a position where you're running short of cash, then it's a folly to keep doing things that are going to deliver value in a year or two's time when you're not going to be there. That's just a waste of money. So I don't want to go there, but if I need to go there, that's the decisions you need to make, the basis in which you need to make your decisions. Being quite extreme and flippant about it, there are some businesses where you have recurring contracts type clients that keep coming to you. You theoretically could shut down the whole of sales and marketing and just carry on delivering services to existing customers. Most businesses, sales and marketing is a big cost. You know, it can be up to half the costs of running a business. And so you've got quite a lot of slack there as the leader to save that money temporarily until times are better. I'm not advocating it particularly. I'm just saying when you're looking, you know, when you're looking into the barrel of the gun, you have to make the decisions you have to make. And so there are things sometimes that you can do to survive, to live another day, and then to rebuild back up later. Not ideal, not what you want to do, but it's being realistic. If you see what I mean.
Yeah, so what's next on the things we should be thinking about?
It feels to me like I could sort of keep pushing on, but there's not really much more. You know, I think there's more than enough there for people to be working on. The only other thing that I do feel I would want to say, and it won't surprise you to say it, and I'm sure you'll agree because we're both involved in that world, I believe that having people around you that you can act as sounding boards that can give you the brilliant dumb advice from a distance is really, really powerful at any time in business. But I think it's especially so when you're facing tough times. It's having somebody you can turn to in confidence and bounce some of this stuff around, because a lot of it is not easy. You know, whether we're talking about the redundancy programs we did in the middle, whether you're talking about cutting back on sales and marketing that you really don't want to do, because it's going to damage the future growth of your business, but you haven't got the cash to do it, so you're going to have to stop it. That making those sort of decisions, there's no magic formula, no simple answer. You know, it's not like the accountant saying, make sure you do a credit check on your customers, which of course is true as well. These are things where, you know, you're making big judgment calls that the health of the business, the future of the business depends upon. And that's where bounce them off some other layperson, common sense business person can be amazingly powerful for getting decent advice and some sanity check on what you're thinking. And so, yeah, I couldn't say strongly enough, be a member of a peer group or have a business coach or a business mentor or somebody like that that can help you deal with these things that are going to be difficult. They're going to be stressful. They're going to be hard work. And that's why you're paid to be the leader. You know, you've got to lead. You've got to make the decisions.
Yeah, there's a phrase I came across which we use, go-to people need people to go to. And if you're that go-to person leading the business and times are tough, well, at any time, but especially when times are tough, then there are some things you just can't talk to your own team about. And it's very helpful to be able to talk to people who have got experience or maybe going through the same challenges and have a few weeks or months ahead of you in the process. It's clear, Bob, you've got so much practical experience. You've lived experience, as we call it, through a number of crises and difficult times, tough times in the economy that you can draw on so readily, examples, but with empathy and with a sense that just because you've done it many times before doesn't take away the human aspect of this. How do you work now with leaders? You said you've recently step back from the business you built up over 20 years and you're now still very active, I know. So how do people work with you? How do you like to work with organizations and business leaders?
Thank you for asking. Firstly, I do like to help business leaders succeed. I've got a number of ways in which I try and do that, and sort of building up really. The first one is my books. Go on Amazon, Bob Bradley Leadership, and you'll find books by me. One there now, second one coming out shortly, and some more to follow. They're basically, I call them reference books, not reading books. I know when I used to, when I was a full-time business leader, I'd get a book and I'd read the first chapter, get the message, and think, I haven't got time to read the rest of the book and move on. This book, it recognizes that. It's, you know, it's a whole load of different thoughts and tips. I expect people to browse through, think, oh, that looks interesting. Oh, I haven't got time to read it now, but I'll bear it in mind and then put it on the shelf. And then 3 weeks' time, they've got a challenge with the salespeople. They think, oh, I'm sure there's something in that book about salespeople. Okay, oh, yes, here it is. Two pages, tell it. See, just give me a pointer as to how you can might manage your sales force, how you might manage redundancies. So books is my first tool and cheapest tool and easiest, most accessible tool. And I don't even see it happen. So just find it on Amazon. Next up is speaking. I speak to groups of business leaders and I speak to senior management teams on business and business leadership. Business leadership is, I call it, strategy and leadership for growth, value and impact. That's the theme of what I do. And I can deliver that, as I say, to groups of business leaders and in-house to senior management teams. If I'm doing in-house, what sometimes clients like to do is to double the time, double the duration to give us time to apply it to their business. So we'll do a module of content and then we'll work on it together. Get started in the business and applying it in the business. So it's almost like a replacement for a strategy consultant. It's getting the senior management team to do it themselves with the advice of somebody who understands these things. So that's the sort of main two routes. I also do business coaching and mentoring. So, you know, I can do one-to-one stuff if people want it. And I know plenty of people who run peer groups. I don't do that myself anymore, but I know people like you, Andy, that do that. So if anybody's wanting to join a business leader peer group, then if they don't want to talk to you for some reason, why that should be, I have no idea. You know, I'm another route to, do you know, a peer group I could join. So that's the whole range of options, really. They're all potentially useful. And yeah, I hope some of your listeners think, oh yeah, I could relate to Bob and love to speak to him. So please do.
Yeah, I can't see why not. And we'll put your LinkedIn details and I think we'll put a link to the book as well, to the first book in the show notes to the episode, so people have got a thread to pull on right away and know how to get in touch with you.
Thank you.
So is there anything I haven't asked you, Bob, that means I've missed an opportunity?
There's loads of stuff I could talk about forever. I love business and I love talking about business. I think I will just finish with one, a bit of preaching, if you like, a sort of pontification, because it's a hobby horse of mine that I love the SME sector, the operational businesses that are beyond startup and below corporate. You know, I love working in that sector because I think that's the engine of the UK economy. And I think the people that lead them are massively maligned by the media. So I want to put that right briefly now, because the media portrays them as selfish, greedy, money grabbing, you know, and having worked with so many business leaders over the years, they're the exception in the SME world. There are very, very few like that in the SME world. Most business leaders are insufficiently commercial, really, because they're passionate about their staff, their customers, their product. And that's what they want to make happen. What I've worked out over the years is that I see business as exactly the same as a charity or public sector organization. They're there to solve a problem in the world. And they're so there to solve a problem in the world so well that somebody's prepared to give money to do that. Whether that be the government using taxpayer money to pay a public sector organization to do something good in the world, whether it be charity using donations or government grants to do something good in the world, or whether we're a business having money from investors and customers to go and solve a problem in the world. So great businesses start with what problem are we there to solve for our customers? How do we solve that brilliantly, so brilliantly they're happy to give us money? Most people are not reluctant to give money to receive a good service or a good product. And that's how businesses work. Businesses should not start out with a spreadsheet saying, who can I get money off and how do I get it off them? Businesses start out with a problem that I can solve so brilliantly people will throw money at me.
Nice message to end on. Thank you very much again, Bob. It's been really a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for sharing all of your experience with us today.
It's been a pleasure talking, Andy, and thank you for inviting me in.
You've been listening to CareerView Mirror with me, Andy Follows. Bob has learnt so much the hard way himself, and then so much more from all the business leaders he's worked with, contributing to their debates about the real challenges they faced in their businesses has given him many insights into the challenges of real practical operational business leaders and how they think, decide and act. Insights he wishes he'd had 40 years ago. Insights he feels it's now his duty to share as widely as possible. If you found this episode valuable, please share it with someone you think might benefit from it. You never know. It could spark an insightful conversation. If you email Bob, he will send you a complimentary copy of his ebook, Survive and Thrive. You'll find Bob's contact details along with links to additional resources in the show notes to this episode. If you're looking for a speaker or workshop facilitator who offers pragmatic advice based on decades of real-world experience, someone who understands the pressures and complexities you face, then connect with Bob. Thank you for listening, and thank you to the CareerView Mirror team and our sponsors, Ask Consulting and Aquilai. If you're curious about joining a peer mentoring group or exploring how the Fulfilling Performance Framework can help you or your organisation, email academy@aquilai.co.uk or check the show notes for more details.
No matter how hard you try, no matter how hardworking you are, you're never going to be able to do it on your own. It's just not possible.
You know, at the end of the day, you're steering your own destiny. So if it's not happening for you and you're not seeing what you want out there, then go out there and connect.
Don't rely on others. You have to do it yourself. You have to take control.
If you've got an idea, if you've got a thought about something that might be successful, if you've got a passion to do something yourself, but you just haven't quite got there, do it.
Take a risk, take a chance, stick your neck out. What's the worst that can happen? You fall down, okay, you pick yourself up and you try again.